British Public Radio. Food and Drink.
Bonjour and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Francois Peretti. Francois is the director of the Champagne Information Bureau. We're going to talk about the history, the protection of the term champagne, rosé champagnes, and of course, Placo Musophiles. Sounds like a terrible fungal disease, doesn't it? But we're going to find out more about that in the interview coming up later on. I've had another busy week for me, school holiday, so I've had the girls at home all week, which is always tough, judging at the International Wine Challenge and lots of meetings regarding Findavino, which is cranking along quite nicely. Very, very busy. Hard to get anything done, though, materially, just moving from one thing to the next all the time. I did have a look at one of the shorts of a new movie coming out soon. I saw the shorts on the website Drinks Business. It's called The Duel of Wine. Part comedy, and it is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek take of the wine industry, and it does have some wine industry grandees in it, such as Michel Roland, but sadly, it isn't going to be out until 2014, but probably worth having a wee look on the Drinks Business website for that review, or maybe it's on YouTube now for the review, The Duel of Wine. But let's get straight on the show, and next up we've got the news with the fabulous Jane.
Online wine retailer Naked Wines has made one Italian winemaker very happy by selling out their wine within 24 hours of it going on their website. They pre-sold over £37,000 worth of the Italian wines after discovering the winemaker at the ProVine exhibition. Having asked 100,000 Naked Wine customers known as Angels what wines they wanted more of, they tasked their Archangels buying team to shortlist wines from unrepresented producers. The chosen winery was La Tabelle Estate in Valpolicella, and the three wines are the straight Valpolicella 2012, the Valpolicella Repasso 2010 vintage, and the Amarone della Valpolicella from 2009, retailing for between £8.99 and £18.99. The Angels spend more than £2 million a month on future orders, which the company uses to fund independent winemakers, in return for exclusive wines and wholesale prices. Naked Wines has a total of 250,000 customers and grew sales by 57%, up to £34.7 million last year.
This is a nice idea, sending some of your top customers to a tasting event, empowering them to make significant buying decisions. It's what the rest of the trade do in terms of going to events to buy wines. So it's nice that Naked Wines get their customers to buy in bulk beforehand based on recommendations from a small team. It's not as radical as it sounds, but the community that Naked Wines has created is a very good case of executing social networking.
Bordeaux First Growth Chateau Margaux has announced the release of a third wine onto the market this year, called Margaux de Chateau Margaux, made from wine that didn't make it into the estate's second label, Pavillon Rouge. The price of the wine has yet to be decided, but around 3,000 cases were made and will be available this autumn rather than being sold on primeur. Margaux de Chateau Margaux was created due to the favourable conditions of the 2009 vintage, which meant that the wine that didn't make it into Pavillon Rouge was of such a high standard it merited its own bottling. Previously, the wine had been declassified and used for generic AOC Margaux.
In the past, Bordeaux's second labels were all about making sure the top label or brand maintained quality. But with the prestige of the top labels now meaning that the second labels can command higher prices than many other top wines, quality needs to be maintained in the second labels. By adding to the top label's mystique to a third label, they can continue to charge handsomely for this wine, above what you'd normally get by selling the grapes on the open market. This means they can improve the quality of the third label, increasing the price, and this virtuous circle is maintained until, like Pavillon Rouge, it outperforms other supposedly better wines.
Well, finally this week, the on-premier tasting got underway in Bordeaux, and as ever, there are differing opinions as to the quality of the vintage. Respected wine critic and Decanter Magazine's consultant editor Stephen Spurrier is largely positive and finds 2012 much better than 2011. But Decanter's Right Bank correspondent James Lawther, MW, says it's an uneven vintage due to the difficulties of the year. On the Right Bank, the successful appellation seems to be Pomerol, which is an early ripening zone. But elsewhere in Saint-Emilion and the other satellite appellations, it very much depends on the terroir and the human input, he says. Meanwhile, American-based Jeff Lev of the Wine Cellar Insider said the further north you go in the Medoc, the greener the tannins become. The best wines he's tried so far have been in Pessac Léognan and Pomerol. That's all from me this week. Don't forget to check these stories out at our website 3050.co.uk.
Okay, with the news out of the way, let's crack on. And this week we're going to have a quick overview in the spotlight looking at sparkling wines. Now, we haven't had a spotlight for a while, but I thought since the interviews with Francoise, we don't really talk about how sparkling wine's made. So I thought I'd give you guys a quick overview. Some of you guys will know all about this. Some of you guys may not have. It's been a long time since we've explained the champagne method to anybody, as well as the traditional tank method. So sparkling wine is simply wine with bubbles. There are a number of ways of making sparkling wines, from the slightly sparkling Vino Verde to the full-on sparkling Prosecco and champagne styles. Wines that have more than a simple spritz are generally made one of three ways. These are tank, traditional, and transfer. I like to call them the three T's, tank, traditional, transfer. The tank method is mainly used by the Italians and is used to make wines such as Prosecco and one of my favorites, Moscato d'Asti. It's sometimes called the Charmant method, although the full name by the two inventors should be Charmant Martinotti, named after the Frenchman Charmant and the Italian Martinotti, who created and perfected the process. The tank method is pretty simple. You start out with a base wine, put it into a big old tank, add some yeast and some sugar, and the yeast gobbles up the sugar, converting it to alcohol. But it does have a byproduct, carbon dioxide. Now, normally this goes off into the atmosphere and helps global warming, but by putting a lid on top of the tank and stopping the bubbles escaping, the pressure from the carbon dioxide starts to increase, and it gets higher and higher and higher until the pressure is so high that the bubbles dissolve into the wine. Once the yeast has eaten up all the sugar, it starves to death and sinks to the bottom of the tank. The wine is then drained off the yeast under pressure and into bottles, and is ready to drink. The key thing here with the tank method is that the wines taste like the base wine. So, for example, with Prosecco, the base wine often has a pear aroma, and in the tank method, you get a pear-smelling, sparkling wine. It makes nice, clean, fruity wines. The traditional method is perhaps the most common method used around the world, and was invented in England and refined in Champagne. It's sometimes referred to the champagne method, but due to all the rules about what is champagne and what you can use outside champagne, I tend to just call it the traditional method rather than get involved in trying to call a method the champagne method for champagne and the traditional method for everywhere else. I just call everything the traditional method these days. The method is similar to the tank method. You start off with a base wine, but this time bottle the still wine and add the yeast and sugar at the time of bottling. Put a bear cap on the top, and again the yeast eats the sugar, creating carbon dioxide. And again the pressure from the CO2 increases more and more and more until the pressure gets so high that the bubbles dissolve into the wine. Once the yeast has eaten all the sugar, it starves to death and sinks to the side of the glass. Side of the glass because the wines are lying on their sides. Note the aging is important here. The wine lies on that dead yeast, picking up yeasty, bready, biscuity flavors, and the yeast slowly breaks down, releasing amino acids and glutamates and all sorts of goodies into the wine. After a period of time, the wine slowly tipped upside down, working the bottle back and forth until the yeast is at the neck of the bottle. The neck is then frozen, and the cap taken off, and the pressure shoots out a slug of the frozen yeast and a bit of wine. It's then topped up and a bit of dead wood stuck in the end, and hey presto, the wine's ready to go. The key flavour in the wine is the added breaded biscuit flavours that come from the method of production. Although good sparkling wines often have a supporting fruit. You often find sparkling rosés often have a lot of red fruits coming from the red wine that's tipped in. The final method is known as the transfer method and is hardly used, although Jacob's Creek Sparkling Pinot Noir uses this method. Here we start out as if we're making a traditional method wine. Start with a base wine and pour it into bottles. Add the yeast and sugar to the bottle, and the yeast gobbles up the sugar, converting it to alcohol and creating some carbon dioxide. Once the yeast has eaten all the sugar, again it sinks to the bottom of the wine, and the wine lies on the dead yeast, picking up yeasty flavors, exactly the same as the traditional method. But here it changes. When the wine's ready to be disgorged, get rid of that dead yeast. What they do is they pour the wine back into a big old tank. You let the yeast settle to the bottom of the tank, and then you drain the wine off the tank, leaving the yeast behind. It's a way of making traditional method style wines with lots of yeasty, bready aromas, but saving a bit of money on all the faffing around that's required to get rid of the dead yeast. Which of these methods is best? It's a matter of personal opinion. Many people like the richness that you get from the yeasty traditional method and the transfer method wines, while others prefer the purity of fruit that comes from the tank method. There's not a right and a wrong, and they create different wines, and it's up to people's personal preferences. You know, if it's a hot summer's day, there's nothing like a nice little glass of Prosecco, whereas champagne can be a lot more food friendly than Prosecco. So, different strokes for different folks. All right, but let's get on straight on with the interview. And as I said at the top of the show, we're going to be talking with Francois Peretti, and we're going to be talking about the history of champagne, the protection of the term champagne, rosé wines, and the rather dodgy sounding Plaxo Musophile. We're going to talk a wee bit about just an overview of champagne, because it's a wine that we've talked about a lot about sparkling wines on the show, but we've never actually spoken about champagne. So, just in a nutshell, what is champagne?
Well, champagne is the best sparkling wine in the world. As simple as that.
So it's a sparkling wine, and it's made to the traditional method. And where is it based in France? I imagine most people...
Well, champagne only comes from Champagne. And the Champagne is 120 kilometers, you know, northeast of Paris.
Mm-hmm. So it's quite close to Paris. And that was the original market for champagne, wasn't it? In the old day, you know, long before sparkling wine was created, champagne was actually known for making, what was it, white wines or?
Well, champagne, if you go back, you know, to ancient times, you know, there was vine, you know, and there were vines all over Champagne, just like today. Mm. The wines that were produced, you know, were quite different from the wines we have and enjoy today. But yes, you had, you know, still wines. You still have still wines, you know, in Champagne today. Very, very small production, but
oh, really?
You can still find them. They're not under the name Champagne, obviously, because yep. Champagne only is only champagne, but they're called, you know, Coteau Champenois, and they come, you know, in white or red. So it's a minute production that is usually, you know, enjoyed in the region.
Yeah. And what sort of grapes do they use for those?
Well, they use exactly the same grape as are used, you know, for champagne, because in the region, you know, you only have, you know, those grapes. So they are two, you know, red grapes, black grapes, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and one white, which is the Chardonnay.
And there's still other grapes allowed to be used in champagne, aren't there? But they're not allowed to be planted or something like that.
Yes, it's not so much that they're not allowed. Yes, I mean, historically, the wines of champagne were produced, you know, with, I think, six or seven different types, you know, of grapes. Mm-hmm. The reason why I think that they became less used is that empirically, you know, people have tested and tried, you know, which grapes among, you know, the wines that they had were best at producing champagne, and the producers, you know, decided that Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and Chardonnay were the best grapes.
Okay, and I heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I use it in my tastings actually as a quiz question. What was champagne famous for before it became famous for sparkling wine? Do you know what it is?
I have no idea, but I guess you're going to tell me.
Wool.
Wool.
Wool. Before sparkling wines, champagne was quite famous for making wool.
Well, wool was, because champagne was on the, you have Troyes. Troyes was one of the big centers of the wool trade, which was not necessarily, because, you know, they had wool that they grew and in the region. It's simply because the wool, trade, especially in the Middle Ages, came from Italy. And, you know, the route, you know, was, Italy, Lyon, and then they went up to Troyes. So there was a big, you know, wool trade.
Oh, okay.
Which it's not because they grew, you know, actual wool like in, you know, South or Dakota or Carolina or, you know, wherever.
New Zealand,
you know, not exactly. And you had lots of sheep that they used, you know.
Oh, okay. Exactly. I always thought that I just imagined these fields of sheep actually, but no, okay. So it was a trading hub.
Yes, it was the trading. And Troyes, which is one of our most, you know, gorgeous medieval towns in France, towns, because, you know, in France, we don't have many medieval towns left. Mm. Like, you know, in other countries in Europe, if you go to Italy, you still have it, in Spain, etc. Not so much in France. So Troyes is a gorgeously preserved medieval town, and it is one of the centers of the big markets, you know, the medieval markets.
Excellent. All right. So when did Champagne start to become like a sparkling wine? Because obviously they were making wines before then, but, you know, this is all about the sparkling wines of Champagne. So when did it really start to become a sparkling wine?
Well, you always had sparkling wines in the region, simply because even before the second fermentation was discovered and mastered, which is much later, the wines of Champagne underwent, like any other wine, a first fermentation. And what would happen is that, you know, the wines would be kept, you know, in the cellars, and the weather would get colder and the fermentation would slow down, and the weather would get warmer and the fermentation would naturally start again.
Yep.
So effervescence in Champagne goes back a very, very long time. But if we go to the definition of what Champagne is today, modern Champagne is a sparkling wine that has undergone a second fermentation within its bottle.
Yep.
The bottle it is sold in. So the second fermentation has to be induced. And also, the second half of what Champagne is must be produced, you know, in the Champagne region, exclusively in the Champagne region in France. So if we go back to the first component of what makes Champagne, Champagne as we know it today really starts, you know, when the second fermentation is induced. And that is, you know, a sort of improvement on natural effervescence.
Yeah. The old effervescence in a bottle was a bit of a problem back then, because of the glass technology wasn't quite up to standard. And if you did get that second fermentation, you could lose lots and lots of bottles of wine, which.
Yes, they used to call it, you know, the devil's wine, because, you know, they felt that, they did not understand why the bottles, you know, would explode in the cellars. And not only they lost a lot of, bottles and wine, but also it scared them, you know, quite significantly.
Yeah.
But
it's like a gunshot, isn't it?
Yeah, it must have been, you know, quite scary. But I think that, you know, we can thank the British, and especially British bottle makers, you know, for, I mean, they can be credited for discovering and much stronger glass that at the time, especially, I think it was in the 18th century, you know, could sustain the pressure of, you know, the sparkle and the effervescence.
Yep.
And the British along the, you know, I mean, I feel a bit British somewhere, you know, having been here for over 20 years. I hope the British won't mind. But I think that the British contributions to modern Champagne, you know, is, you know, are quite, you know, significant.
Yeah. We've done shows in the past talking about Christopher Merritt and the Coopers adding molasses and sugar to make the wine sparkly. So deliberately doing that fermentation in the past. So I don't really want to cover it here. Probably the most important part that I thought in the sort of history of Champagne was Madame Clicquot's discovery of riddling or getting rid of that dead yeast out of the bottom.
Champagne was never discovered. You know, when people say to me, you know, who discovered Champagne? I said, no one discovered Champagne. It is a succession of not discoveries, but contributions of observations. And, you know, the riddling, the second fermentation, the technology as we know it today, you know, all lead, you know, from those observations. And of course, you know, great improvements and, you know, steps, you know, in champagne production.
Do you know when they started removing the dead yeast, when that was sort of first started as a part of the process?
I don't know the exact date, no.
Okay.
I mean, what we know about the dead yeast is that because we have paintings and we also have glasses. So we know that in the 18th century, They must have been drinking champagne that was pretty cloudy, because they actually had the pompon, you know, their glasses did not have a foot. The glass was footless, and they drank it and put it back on a little sort of plate, because they got rid of the sediments which were in the glass.
Oh,
that
really?
Way. So we know, you know, pretty cloudy.
Okay. Now, what is Champagne? Is it a department? Is it a region? Because a lot of French wine regions seem to be broken down by department. But I don't think of Champagne as a department.
It's a region.
How does it fit within the hierarchy of France? You know, because France has departments, don't they?
Yes, but the département, you have several départements, you know, in the Champagne region.
Okay.
So département is a much smaller, but here we're talking about, you know, this is the Champagne region, which is much broader than the département. I need to double check, but I think you've got three départements in the region.
Okay, so Champagne actually is a region that encompasses multiple administrative areas.
Correct.
Okay, and I originally thought that Champagne was the name of the soils, like in Cognac, they produce fine Champagne Cognac, and the reference to the Champagne there is a reference to the soils, which are the same soils as in Champagne. Is that how you understood the name came about?
No, it's not exactly how, you know, the word Champagne can only be used in Champagne. It refers...
And Cognac.
No, I'm coming back to that. The only region that still uses is Cognac, and it does not refer to the soil. It's simply because Champagne comes from the Latin campagna, that meant, you know, flat soil, meant la campagne, which is the rural area in Latin.
Oh, okay.
So historically, the Cognacais have been using fine Champagne. It's the only region outside the Champagne region that uses the word Champagne is the Cognacais, as you mentioned, because they mention Grande and Petite Champagne. It doesn't mean that the soils are similar, because they're not. It means that it comes from the same etymological word, which is the root, which is Campagna, the Latin Campagna, that means, you know, rural flatlands. And that's the only reason.
Just if you're wondering why the police are thing,
it's not for us.
It's not for
it's us. It's not for us.
We're
Chris.
We're recording.
We haven't called the police to take him away.
We're recording this on the corner of Earl's Court and the A4, and it's quite a busy road. I think there's a highway for the policemen. And how come they were allowed to keep the name? Because everywhere else, pretty much everywhere except for parts of America, which make traditional champagnes, which I love. Everybody else has sort of been banned or you know, had their arm twisted behind their back to not use the term. But in Cognac, they haven't had their arm twisted too far. So what's going on there? Is there pressure to stop
them? We have to ask them.
Okay. You don't know why, or?
We have to ask the Cognacais.
I'm surprised, because the EU gets quite nickety about that sort of stuff. You know, they've made everybody, like Tokaj and Alsace had to change because it might be confused with a Hungarian Tokaj and all sorts of stuff. So I just thought that was quite interesting. A little bit of inconsistency there by the rule makers in the EU.
You've got to ask Brussels.
Okay, no, that's cool. All right, so we've sort of talked a wee bit about the history. Is it's not really an invention, it's more of an evolutionary process. And then I think the last step was the use of the muzzle on the top. I heard they used to use rags and all sorts of stuff to try and keep the wine in, but that wouldn't have kept the bubbles in. Have you heard much about the old stoppers before cork?
Yes, I think, of course, I think it was not only rags. It was, there were wooden pegs wrapped in cloth.
Oh, okay.
I think, you know, they were just trying, and then you had probably sort of, you know, sort of natural straw to hold it. Must have been, you know, quite a production. It's a bit easier today.
Yeah.
And okay. A bit more scientific.
And a bit more interesting with the tops. Have you heard of the term, how's this one for you? This will throw you. Plaxomusophile.
No, tell me about it.
I'd never heard of it either. Plaxomusophile is the term used for someone who collects the tops of the champagne. You know those,
the very tops
that have like, often they have like really beautiful pictures in them and all sorts of stuff. And some people collect them.
Yes, I know. So that's their names.
And Plexomusifer. It sounds like some sort of terrible disease, but I had a lady do a presentation to me once about it. And I've always thought that was quite interesting.
And
do you know the reason why some people put so much effort into it? And some of them have even got the image on the inside, so you can't even see it on the bottle.
Yeah. Well, I think it's all part of the individuality of champagne. You know, a lot of there's a lot of individualism, you know, in the Champagne region. And I think it's the way historically that people, you know, want to talk about their history.
Let's talk a wee bit about the method of production. You know, we've been talking a bit about the evolution of the production, but Champagne is one of the few regions that are allowed to make rosé wine by adding red wine in. I thought it was hilarious about, was it about 2 years ago, the EU said, oh, we're going to allow everybody to make red wine by adding white and red, and everybody got an up in arms about this being the most appalling thing ever. And then not many people in Champagne make rosé wines by leaving the juice in contact with the skins. There are a couple of producers, I understand, but...
Well, there are quite a few. But I think that both methods of producing rosé are now, you know, totally accepted in the Champagne region. I think at the end of the day, it depends what you are looking for. Both methods are widely accepted, and it very much depends, you know, what you are looking for. And, you know, with the skin contact method, you know, you can end up with red champagne, for instance, which is not allowed in Champagne. If you were to produce a red champagne in Champagne, you'd have, you know, it wouldn't be called champagne. So I think that the other method is probably more reliable in terms of color. And of course, you know, the degree of color very much gives you an indication of the taste, the flavors of the pink. Of course. The darker it is, the more fruitful it will be, the more fruity it will be, the more full bodied it will be, simply because you will have left, you know, the skins, you know, on in contact, you know, with the wine, you know, much longer. That's, you know, that's how you produce, as you know, red wine.
Yeah, yeah. So you'll get more
fruit if you just give a little tinge of pink, you know. I mean, I think this is the beauty of pink champagne, because you have a wide variety of champagne anyway. And this is also reflected in the pink category, where you can have, you know, I mean, consumers have different tastes. You have consumers who love, you know, drinking champagne, just pink champagne, because it's got a nice little color, but they're not crazy about, you know, fruity or full-bodied champagne. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have people who will actually go for a very full-bodied vintage rosé, which can go very well, even with, you know, pheasant or capon or, you know, white meat, but some, you know, fairly richer, you know, type of meat.
Okay, then. I think we're going to wrap it up there, Françoise, and we'll come back to this next week. To finish up the show, we've got our quote, and it's from Will Rogers. He's an American cowboy, vaudeville performer, humorous social commentator, and motion picture actor. Wine had such ill effects on Noah's health, all he could do was live to 950 years old. Show me a total abstinencer who ever lived that long. Food for thought. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a British public radio presentation in association with the wine tasting company 3050. For more, go to 3050.co.uk.